From my secret underground studios, you're listening to Free Radio Olympia. This is the Thunderbolt for January 31st, 2020. The views expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. This is a fifth Friday, meaning that it's time for the Thunderbolt's greatest strikes. And this week's show barely fits into my new time format, so we're going to get right to it here without all the usual bells and whistles. This is Revolutionary Lessons. Enjoy. To quote George Orwell, "He who controls the past controls the present. He who controls the present controls the future." The story that we tell ourselves about who we are is very important. Telling the American story is somewhat problematic due to the fact that basically our ancestors stole an entire continent by conducting a genocidal slaughter upon the native inhabitants and enslaving millions of other people to do the hard work. The fact that this has been turned into a noble and glorious accomplishment is a great credit to American propagandists. Well, I think that in order to become all that we can be, we need to be honest about where we have been. And I think we should acknowledge both the good and the bad. Now, my theory may be wrong, but I think honesty is usually the best policy. And that is why I am such an iconoclast. That is why I gut sacred cows with such enthusiasm. Now, the American Revolution was indeed quite revolutionary for its time. And those people did take some very serious risks. The Founding Fathers created not only a political revolution, but they radically altered the very philosophy underlying the relations between government and the people. But as brilliant and as radical as the Founding Fathers were, their hypocrisy was also astonishing. The creator of the phrase, "all men are created equal," owned human slaves. Now, Thomas Jefferson said and wrote some of the coolest shite that has ever been said and written in all human history. But Jefferson was one of the most cutthroat and effective backstabbers, i.e. one of the most accomplished politicians in all human history. Now, to be fair, the reality at that time and place was quite different than it is now. And pretty much all politicos in all eras always play such games.
Afraid to see, but I close my eyes.
Vicious games, vicious games.
Anyway, the American Revolution largely consisted of American aristocrats hiring American rabble to fight hired British rabble so that the American aristocrats could stop being ripped off by the East India Company. In many ways, they were not nice people, even considering the context. For instance, the horrific treatment that was meted out to the loyalists i.e. the 30% of the American population who thought that splitting from England might not be such a hot idea, their treatment was totally unforgivable. During the Revolution,
with different names.
George Washington lived in decadent comfort while his troops froze.
With different names.
He ate catered luxury meals while his troops starved.
Now that you've gone and you have left me, I had to learn. I had to learn how much it hurts.
He often yelled at and beat enlisted men, and he ruthlessly executed deserters. After the war, the government ripped off all the soldiers, and when they returned home, many of them discovered that while they had been freezing the front of their backsides at Valley Forge, Alexander Hamilton's gangster buddies had been stealing all of their homes and throwing all of their families out onto the streets. These outrages eventually culminated into Shay's Rebellion, which was brutally suppressed by federal troops. Then, when a bunch of other veterans got pissed at being ripped off, they organized what was called the Whiskey Rebellion, since it was largely a protest against a crippling whiskey tax. In this case, George Washington personally led American troops not only against American citizens, but against veterans who had endured insanity to win Washington's revolution for him. This was the only instance in our entire history wherein a president personally led troops into the field, and it was against American veterans. One prop that I will give to George Washington: as far as I can figure, up to that time, George Washington was one of the only, if not the only, head of state to ever voluntarily give up power. When Washington announced that he would be voluntarily stepping down as president, his nemesis, King George III, stated that Washington had been, quote, placed in a light the most distinguished of any man living, and that he was, quote, the greatest character of the age. And one other prop I will give to George Washington: he did not abuse his demigod status nearly as much as he could have. I think George Washington knew full well that he had carved out quite the legend for himself, and I believe that he did not want to do anything stupid during the last phase of his career to mess that up. And so, other than marching troops on American veterans, he was otherwise mostly Mr. Cautious, don't rock the boat during his time as president. Then, John Adams won the presidency in 1796, but after a bruising, down and dirty, mud-slinging election in 1800, that makes our modern elections seem genteel and modest by comparison, Thomas Jefferson and his acolytes James Madison and James Monroe used their velvet-covered iron Virginia fists to grasp control of the executive branch of the American government, and then they firmly held on to it for the next 24 years. At the time, it seemed as if the Jeffersonian farmer-agrarian vision of America had won out over the Adams-Hamiltonian vision of an industrial America dominated by economic elites. Dream on.
There'll be no one to stop us this time.
Another player in this game was Aaron Burr. Now, Mr. Burr was one of George Washington's soldiers at Valley Forge, and Mr. Burr was probably involved in the Conway Cabal, which is an effort to replace George Washington as the commanding general. For in addition to being an arrogant and classist a-hole, George Washington was also probably one of the worst generals ever to win a war. And actually, the French won the American Revolution anyway, so saying that Washington won it isn't even accurate to begin with. During the few instances where Washington actually stopped running away from the British long enough to stand and fight them, he got his butt kicked nearly every time. Though, to be honest, it was actually his troops that got their butts kicked nearly every time. Now, the troops of other American generals, such as Horatio Gates and Charles Lee, actually won most of their battles. But while they were accomplished generals, Gates and Lee were lousy politicians. They tended to call two-faced jerks, two-faced jerks. And since most politicians are two-faced jerks, then Gates and Lee suffered in the public relations department as a result. George Washington, on the other hand, had the politics down. He flattered and kissed.
You are not a Jedi. Get
all of the proper rear ends. And he made all the proper, quote, friends, unquote. And thus came out on top in the end. Now, John Adams and Alexander Hamilton were political allies, but they loathed each other on a personal level. Both of those things,
you are not a Jedi yet,
can also be said about Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr. Political enemies Jefferson and Hamilton often commiserated with each other over their mutual loathing of Aaron Burr, as did political enemies Thomas Jefferson and John Adams over their mutual personal nemesis, Alexander Hamilton. Anyway, after several months of vicious file mudslinging, the incredibly foul election of 1800 resulted in ostensible allies Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr each tied with 73 electoral votes. Ironically, this left the decision of who would be the next president to the House of Representatives, which was, at this point, still under the control of the now lame duck Federalist Party, who were thus tasked with choosing which Democratic Republican enemy would assume the presidency. Both candidates were utterly loathsome some to the Federalists. And for almost a week, the House cast a total of 35 ballots, with both Jefferson and Burr receiving just shy of the number of votes needed to win. Then, Jefferson and Burr engaged in some sort of backroom deal whereby Burr would whisper in the proper New England ears to allow Jefferson to win the election in exchange for some unknown future consideration. Most historians think that Jefferson promised some kind of support for something at some future time, but no one ever really kissed and told on that one. So the facts surrounding this alleged deal are merely alleged facts. Now, Aaron Burr was an ambitious politician who was neither much better nor much worse than any of his contemporaries. But his name was destined to become shrouded in rumors and controversy. However, of all the rogues who gave us our country, Aaron Burr has always been one of my personal favorites. This fondness is due partly to his controversial nature, but there were also several other things. He was a feminist, for one thing. Now, most people do know that shortly after assuming the vice presidency, Aaron Burr shot and killed Alexander Hamilton in a duel, which means that Dick Cheney was not the first American vice president to shoot someone while in office.
All aboard, said Captain Tom, we're sailing west, we're here away. You better leave your hose at home when Jolly Roger's laughing through the rain.
I got the map, I got the plan, a wooden leg and a hairy chest. I may be blind, I may be deaf, but you will know I am the best. Yo ho ho and a bottle of rum, we're sailing west into the sun. Of hell and hurricanes, no gold, no women, no cocaine. And Captain Tom has gone insane, and Jolly Roger's laughing through the rain. The show is already here for the meal. Save your ass and stash your cash. The balls and nerves are made of steel. We suck the bones and rotten flesh.
Now, what most people do not know is that the reason Aaron Burr called Alexander Hamilton out was because Hamilton had publicly conjectured that Burr was having sexual relations with his own daughter, Theodosia. Now, it is important to understand that at that time and at that place, and under the code of honor by which these men lived, calling out Hamilton
into the sun
for such an egregious slander
into the sun
was Burr's only possible recourse.
Into the sun.
Now, concerning Burr's daughter, Theodosia, Burr's beloved wife had died in 1793, and Aaron Burr never remarried until much later in his life. Now, during the period in question, Theodosia became Burr's social secretary, hostess, and confidant. Aaron
Aaron Burr educated his daughter in a manner that was almost completely unprecedented at the time, and Theodosia could effectively debate on many topics, even with the likes of Thomas Jefferson. Now, Theodosia was always at Burr's side, and he trusted her with every aspect of everything that was happening during these very intense and very exciting times. The one comment that everyone who knew them made was that Aaron and Theodosia Burr very obviously adored each other. And it seems probable that this situation was at least partly responsible for Alexander Hamilton's erroneous and eventually fatal conjecture about the nature of their relationship. Now, while Aaron Burr won the duel, he lost his career. Alexander Hamilton became a martyr, while Aaron Burr was condemned, lied about, and vilified. The actual reason for the duel was not widely known, and Aaron Burr did not want the reason to be widely known, and so the Hamilton-Burr duel was widely considered to be the simple elimination of a political rival by means most foul. Aaron Burr's rep was toast. And then, after the duel, Thomas Jefferson saw his opportunity to kick a dog that was already down, and he not only squelched on whatever deal he had made with Aaron Burr, but Jefferson later had Burr railroaded into court on a totally fabricated bull fucking charge of treason. For after his ostracism, Aaron Burr had gone to Tennessee, whereupon he started raising an army with which he planned to invade Mexico, whereupon he planned to make himself the Emperor of Mexico, whereupon he planned to ally himself with the United States. He figured that under this scenario, then the quote, good guys, i.e. English white people, would then have complete dominion over the entirety of North America. But this plan was squelched when Thomas Jefferson suborned perjury and manufactured evidence in an effort to prosecute Burr by alleging that Burr was raising this army in order to invade the United States. It was a completely preposterous charge, and everyone who knew Aaron Burr understood that he was not stupid enough to do such a thing, even if he had had any such inclination to do such a thing in the first place, which he most certainly did not. And even though Aaron Burr was eventually acquitted of all charges, Jefferson's move utterly destroyed any political ambition that Jefferson's ambitious rival Aaron Burr might have still possessed. Bada boom. So Theodosia had married in 1801, becoming Theodosia Burr Alston. Then, in 1812, Theodosia set sail on a ship that subsequently disappeared at sea without a trace. Now, many legends subsequently grew up around this happenstance, and the legend of Theodosia's disappearance is an interesting story in and of itself. Aaron Burr ended up surviving until 1836. Thus, Mr. Burr outlived all of his rivals by a goodly amount. Aaron Burr subsequently spent his waning years living as something of a gigolo, hustling rich widows, and enjoying the life of a celebrity bon vivant. Thus, after his fall from grace, and after recovering from the loss of his beloved daughter, Aaron Burr, at least, seems to enjoy the rest of his life. And I guess that ultimately, that means that Aaron Burr won the game. So that's it for Revolutionary Lessons Part 1. Tune in to the August 19th show for Revolutionary Lessons Part 2. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams.
And actually, since this is a rerun, you only need to wait for a quick station break to hear the next part. So stay tuned.
The views expressed on the Thunderbolt are my views, and no one else's. Those views do not necessarily reflect the views of any of the stations that air the Thunderbolt, nor anybody that has anything to do with any of those stations. And now, back to the Thunderbolt.
All right, moving right along here. For the August 5th show, I aired a Thunderbolt called Revolutionary Lessons Part 1. It was a somewhat iconoclastic view of the American Revolution, and the title of that piece would seem to imply that a Part 2 would follow. And indeed, I promised Part 2 at the end of Part 1, but we have since decided Revolutionary Lessons Part 2 should be about the aspects of the American Revolution that we don't know about. And since we don't know about them, then I can't talk about them. And so I'm afraid that Revolutionary Lessons Part 2 will have to exist somewhere in some other dimension that maybe we can access someday. But that means that we will skip right to Revolutionary Lessons, Part 3. One of the most fascinating exchanges between public officials that I have ever checked out was the correspondence that occurred betwixt Thomas Jefferson and John Adams during the waning years of their lives. Now, to understand this exchange, you will need some context. During the American Revolution, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson had been personal friends. Adams was, in point of fact,
something of a mentor to Thomas Jefferson. And in point of fact, it was Adams who had drafted Jefferson to write the Declaration of Independence. However, once the United States was up and running, it turned out that their visions of what the country should be were utterly and diametrically opposed. Basically, Thomas Jefferson was an anarchist, whilst John Adams was a fascist. Thomas Jefferson was the pastoral farmer, whilst John Adams was a capitalist industrialist. Thomas Jefferson was the utopian dreamer, whilst John Adams was of the practical realpolitik school of thought. Thomas Jefferson believed that humanity was good at heart and able to take care of themselves, whilst John Adams thought that humanity was depraved at heart and needed an iron fist to keep them civilized. During his administration, Adams actually made it illegal to criticize him, and he threw numerous newspaper editors into prison for doing so.
Mother
boo. John Adams and Thomas Jefferson became near mortal enemies during the election of 1800. And when Jefferson eventually won, Adams did not even bother to stick around long enough to attend Jefferson's inaugural and swearing-in ceremony. After this, they neither spake nor did they correspond for the next 12 years. Finally, in 1812, Adams contacted Jefferson and thus began their historic correspondence that continued until nearly the end of their lives. Mostly, they discussed their mutual invention, the United States of America. Both men obviously had the ulterior motive of putting the American Revolution on the record, so to speak. But it is also obvious that they both felt a very powerful personal desire to justify each to the other, for Adams and Jefferson were almost literally the definition of an odd couple. One conclusion they both readily acknowledged, though, was that each of them was incomplete without the other, that they were two faces of the same coin. One observer had called them the North and South Poles of the American Revolution. Both Thomas Jefferson and John Adams were off the hook in their various, very different manners, but they actually balanced each other out very nicely, and in the end, they were both smart enough to realize it. But whatever else you want to say about them, just remember this. More than anyone else, it was John Adams and Thomas Jefferson who were the central driving force behind the writing of the Declaration of Independence. And signing that document was a very serious thing. An alarmingly large number of the signers ended up losing everything that they had as a result of their act. 17 of the 56 signers of the Declaration, for instance, were financially wiped out by the war that they had declared and they ended up dying in poverty. Four of them lost all of their children as a result. And every single one of them eventually had to flee their homes at one point or another. And after the war, 12 of them returned to find their homes in rubble. And so on. And in addition to all of that, had England won the war, all of the survivors would very likely have faced execution. Yes, kids, these guys were placing very large bets and taking a very large risk, and they do indeed deserve some props for that. So anyway, of all the signers of the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson and Adams were also destined to become the last two survivors. And then, incredibly, they not only both died on the very same day, but, incredibly, the day that they both died was July 4th, 1826, which was, incredibly, the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Huh. Incredible. Who says that magic does not happen? As foul as I consider such a large portion of the American experiment to be, even I must admit that there was some pretty powerful stuff going on during those exciting times. And one more little observation on the Jefferson Adams thing. It is said that Adams' dying words were, "Jefferson yet lives." If so, then that meant that this was Adams' very last concern. If so, then that meant that it was very likely that it seriously bugged John Adams that Jefferson was surviving him. Now keep in mind, for the rest of their adult lives, the United States had been ruled by the Jeffersonian vision. The Virginia Junta were not dislodged from the White House until 1824. And for this entire time, Jefferson was considered to be an American hero, while Adams was considered to be something of an embarrassment. And now, even in the great final game, it appeared as if Jefferson had beat Adams even on that ground. And the joke in all of this, of course, is the fact that in yet another example of pure irony, Jefferson had actually ended up dying a few hours before Adams did, and thus in the end, Adams did achieve his final concern. He did survive Jefferson. He just never knew it. Now, Thomas Jefferson's dying concern was whether or not it was the 4th of July yet. When informed that it was indeed the 4th of July, Thomas Jefferson reportedly smiled and then promptly died. On his way out, I can imagine Mr. Jefferson smiling to himself and saying, "Cool, I did good. Now I'm done. Catch you all down the road."
And thus ends part one of The Thunderbolt, Why You Should Be Upset. Next comes part two, What Can Be Done About It? Across Cascadia, the masses are arising in response to
the Olympia Action Alert
for the week of February 1st through February 7th, 2020. Yeah, it's time for the Thunderbolt calendar, and this first event is totally personal for me because this is a memorial for a friend of mine. His list of accomplishments is entirely too long to fit into this show, but Tom Nogler has been around forever, and his list of accomplishments is truly extraordinary. A lot of things are not going to get done now. So anyway, several people organized this event, and this is their message. Thomas Wilson Nogler died on January 4th, 2020. He was loved by many and will be missed by many, including me on both those counts. There will be a celebration of Tom's life on Saturday, February 1st, beginning at 10 a.m. at the Capitol Theater, 206 Fifth Avenue Southeast, Olympia. Memorial donations may be made to the Olympia Public Power Campaign, 1325 10th Avenue Southeast, Olympia, 98501. Again, that's 1325 10th Avenue Southeast, 98501. This is for a celebration of life, Tom Nogler, Saturday, February 1st. 10 a.m. at the Capitol Theater, 206 Fifth Avenue Southeast. Also later this morning, Saturday, February 1st, there's an Orca Recovery Work Party. This will be from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at 701 West Bay Drive, Northwest. Unfortunately, this interferes with the Tom Nogler Memorial, so I'm afraid I won't be there. But if you want to go on an Orca Recovery Work Party, then here's some information. This event was organized by the Thurston Conservation District, and this is their message. People will be volunteering at an Orca Recovery Work Party to continue being a part of the solution. In October, 85 community members came together to restore the shoreline of Bud Inlet at West Bay Park. Let's continue creating better habitat for our southern resident orca whales and the vital salmon that feed them by helping restore the Garfield Nature Trail, a critical runoff area located near Bud Inlet. Come prepared with sturdy shoes and a reusable water bottle to remove invasive plants. Water, coffee, snack, tools, and gloves, they'll all be there. Parking is available at the West Bay Park, which is across the street from the Garfield Nature Trail. All questions, people will be contacting Kiana Sinner. The email is ksinner, S-I-N-N-E-R, at thurstoncd.com. Again, that's ksinner. At thurstoncd.com, or we have a phone number here. That'd be 360-754-3588, extension 105. So again, that's 754-3588, extension 105. That's for information about the Orca Recovery Work Party, Saturday, February 1st, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at 701 West Bay Drive at Northwest. Also, later today, Saturday, February 1st, we have the 5th Annual Eye to Eye Dinner. This will be from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the Good Shepherd Olympia, 1601 North Street, Southeast.
This event was organized by the Interfaith Works Homeless Services Program, and this is their message. People will be joining us for our fifth annual Eye to Eye fundraising dinner. Always fun, heartfelt, genuine, unique, and delicious, thanks to our caterers, the Wayside Cafe and Deli. Even though we are in a new location this year to accommodate more people, the event will include family-style dinner, a short program, and the opportunity to support the work we do in the community. Stay tuned for more info and check out our website to see all of our sponsors who support us and to purchase your tickets. For anyone who wants to attend but can't afford the ticket price, there are lots of volunteer opportunities, and people will be getting in touch by emailing Meg, M-E-G, at iwshelter.org. Also, we always get sponsors to host tables for our current and former guests to be able to attend. So people who fit that description should reach out and let us know you'd like to come, because we'd love to have you. I have an information email about the organizer here. That's info@iwshelter.org. So again, this is the fifth annual Eye to Eye Dinner, Saturday, February 1st, 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the Good Shepherd Olympia, 1601 North Street, Southeast. All right, now we jump to Monday, February 3rd. It's Clean Energy Thurston. This will be at 6 p.m. at the Mekong Restaurant, which is at 125 Columbia Street Northwest. This event was organized by Clean Energy Thurston, and this is their message. We meet the first and third Mondays of each month at 6 p.m. at the Mekong Restaurant on Columbia Street in the back room. We aim to get ahead on eliminating and replacing dirty power. The food is good as well. So again, this is Clean Energy Thurston. They're evidently a regular meeting. This is Monday, February 3rd, 6 p.m. at the Mekong Restaurant, 125 Columbia Street Northwest. All right, then next we have Tuesday, February 4th. It's the State of Public Power with Dennis Kucinich and friends. This will be from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Olympia Center, 222 Columbia Street Northwest. This event was organized by Power to the Public, and this is their message. Former U.S. Representative Dennis Kucinich will be pumping up the crowds with his characteristic passion, launching our Thurston Public Power Initiative. Kucinich got his start in politics, fighting and winning a battle to keep public the Cleveland Municipal Electrical Company, which was on the verge of being privatized during the early onslaught of neoliberal vulture capitalism. He has been a passionate expert on protecting public utilities and fighting a system that works to benefit the few rather than the many. This is a great alternative to Donald Trump's State of the Union speech. People will be coming to be inspired. So again, this is the State of Public Power with Dennis Kucinich and friends, Tuesday, February 4th, from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Olympia Center, 222 Columbia Street Northwest. And next we go to Wednesday, February 5th. It's Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Day. This will be from 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Washington State Labor Council. That's at 906 Columbia Street Northwest. This event was organized by the Washington Immigrant Solidarity Network, Red de Solidaridad de Migrantes in Washington. And please forgive my Yankee accent. So this is their message. People will be joining us in Olympia to get trained on how to speak to lawmakers, meet other immigrants' rights activists, and attend meetings with our legislators. Together, we will be speaking in one voice to say that immigrants and refugees make Washington a great place to live, work, and thrive. So again, this is Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Day, Wednesday, February 5th, 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Washington State Labor Council Building, 906 Columbia Street Northwest. And finally, we come to Friday, February 7th. We have Bands for Bernie, The Hinges, The Remainders, and more. This will be from 6 to 10 p.m. at Octopus Cafe. That's at 414 East 4th Avenue. This event was organized by Stuart Reed. And this is the message. Ballots go out for the Washington State presidential primary on February 21st. We will be gathering together and rallying our support for President Bernard Sanders and our revolution. This event was organized by independent volunteers and is not affiliated with the official Bernie Sanders for President 2020 campaign. So again, this is Bands for Bernie, including The Hinges, The Remainders, and more. Friday, February 7th, from 6 to 10 p.m. at Octopus Cafe. And this is listed as East 4th Avenue, but I believe it's actually 4th Avenue East, if that makes any difference. I'm sure if you want to find it, you'll be able to find it. So that's it for this week's show. I'll leave you with this very important message.
This is the Fear Report. Approximately 35,000 people died in traffic accidents in the United States last year. ISIS claims responsibility.
Yes, we killed them all. If America does not surrender, 500,000 people will die next year from non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
First, the cults came for your children. Now they're here for your pets.
Repeat after me. Hail Satan.
The Drug Enforcement Agency warns of a new drug called Roundies. Amateur chemists synthesize it from ordinary roast chicken.
We got people coming into the Costco buying 20, 30 whole chickens. They say their church is having a raffle.
Meanwhile, local police stations nationwide are running short on military-grade tanks and nuclear missiles. Should we be concerned? We ask an expert.
Yes.
And we interview child expert Glenn Hibbert. Glenn, what does it mean when a baby cries?
It might be autistic.
Stay tuned to the Fear Report. Otherwise, they win.
The Thunderbolt is a production of Dancing Angel Media, which is solely responsible for the content. Neither the stations that air the Thunderbolt, their sponsors, their members, their underwriters, nor anyone else that has much to do with anything else in any way is responsible for the content of the Thunderbolt, nor do they necessarily agree with the views expressed on the Thunderbolt. If you have any comments, or if you wish to express an opposing opinion, you should send an email to dana98501@gmail.com, and we will make arrangements. And I hope that you have a day.
And please note that the Thunderbolt is on Facebook, where you can find links to the show and to the show notes, or you can now go directly to the Thunderbolt WordPress site, which is at dana98501.wordpress.com.
Thank you very much.